This is Authors in Focus.
Hi, I'm Michael Levin. I'm a writer, publisher, and author publicist. Want a fun satirical read? Check out the Cider and Ale Chronicles. It's currently available on Amazon. And coming soon, get ready for the adventures of Max and the Captain. Today on the podcast, we welcome J.E. Taylor, author of Season of the Dragon and many other great urban fantasy series. Welcome back to the Authors in Focus podcast. I'm Michael Levin. Today I'm joined by J.E. Taylor, a prolific author of Season of the Dragon, among many, many others. How are you doing today, Jay?
I'm doing good. It's Sunday. The sun's not out like it was the other day, but I'm in New Hampshire and that's to be expected.
Yeah, well, I'm in Toronto and it's Canada, this part of Canada,
gray.
This time of year is gray and cold and, you know, we're all in need of some vitamin D.
Exactly.
But it is what it is. It's actually raining today, which is a lot better than snowing. I think it's actually in the plus.
Okay.
In the positives, which yesterday was minus 18 or something like that. So
that's a little cold. I mean, it was 7 degrees here. So
I would kill for 7 degrees right now. But Jane, I always like to start these interviews off before we get into the heavy stuff with a couple of fun questions just to kick it off. So my first question is if you could have a drink or, you know, a non-alcoholic beverage with any author, living or dead, who would it be and why?
Any author? Probably Stephen King, because he's prolific and writes the kind of horror that I love. And he's not too far from me.
Yeah, that's right. He does live fairly close to there.
Yeah, he lives in Maine, and, you know, our summer place is in Maine, so...
Very cool. It's funny, the last three authors that I've interviewed, because I always begin with that question, have been King.
Well, I grew up on his horror. I read everything by him when I was a kid and just absolutely loved it. And my favorite, up until this year, my favorite all-time book was The Stand. But it got eclipsed by somebody else this year.
You know,
in a completely different genre, too.
You know what I love about Stephen King's stuff, more than the supernatural horror element of it, is the way he gets inside the minds of his characters in those italicized passages that are kind of like stream of consciousness.
Yes.
I add a lot. He's a huge influence. Actually, specifically the Dark Tower series and his metafictional kind of breaking of the fourth wall and bringing himself into the books as a character. The way he brings every book that he writes into that Dark Tower world in some way is a brilliant thing about him. My only ever criticism really of a Stephen King book is never in his writing, and in his characterization is brilliant. It's that sometimes the endings happen a little bit too fast.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you've got this amazing built-up story where you love these characters, and all of a sudden, in like 20 pages of supernatural stuff at the end, they're all wiped out and that's it.
They all die. Yes.
I mean, he's not the only one. I mean, like similar things have happened in fantasy with like George R.R. Martin and stuff like that. Too. But
no character is safe.
That's cool. I definitely agree with you. I would say that, that he's an influence of mine and definitely somebody that would be cool to meet. Probably, mine would be James Joyce, who is my all-time favorite author, Ulysses being my all-time favorite book. It would be easier probably to meet Stephen King than James Joyce.
Yeah, probably.
at least right now, and I'm very
right
happy.
Right now, yes.
So my next question is, so we're talking about, I'm asking this question about media. Okay, so it can be books, television, video gaming, movies, music, anything.
Okay.
I don't like to use the term guilty pleasure, really, because when it comes to stuff like this, I kind of don't think that there's anything people should be necessarily guilty about. But if there was something in the media that you really loved or were really drawn to that a lot of people would be really surprised about, what would that be?
Well, it's not surprising, but, you know, my guilty pleasure is Supernatural and have been for 15 years before it went off the air. And I still, you know, love all the memes and, you know, some of the ideas for book series came from that, either from me or from my son. So it really is. I mean, my husband used to roll his eyes at me every time I watched it, although he did like the Scooby-Doo crossover. He actually watched that with me. So
it's a really cool show. I can't say that I necessarily liked it as much as the Joss Whedon shows like Buffy and Angel and Firefly. Definitely influenced and had elements. I think it might have gone on a little bit too long. Like some of the seasons started to, by the end, it was like, okay, what are we going to do now?
Right. Which what are we going to, you know, what's the Trump up? What's the Trump, you know, the bigger bad.
Right. So somewhere between, season, I don't know, 4 and 7, when they graduated out of bad guy of the day, and started getting into some bigger overall story arcs. That was when I think the show really, shined, I should say. I'm definitely a fan of the show. It's a CW show, and I tend to, my guilty pleasures when it comes to media tend to be CW shows anyway. Like I've Arrow and Flash. You know, I kind of like them all. I don't know if I'm the target demographic. I think they're probably geared to people a little bit younger than me, but I still really enjoy them.
Yeah, my son used to watch all that while I was writing, so you know, it sort of came in the peripheral when my daughter wasn't, you know, watching all the chick flicks.
And then for music, I don't know. I've always had a lot of respect for Taylor Swift as a songwriter, even though when I say that, people kind of roll their eyes at me. I'm a musician and former songwriter myself, doing that for many years, and I can appreciate somebody who is able to connect with their audience and know their audience and tap into that as well as she's able to do, because I don't think that there's anyone that can do that like she does right now.
Right. Yeah, I'm a rock girl. So that's
me too.
The other thing about
Supernatural, well, I'm not a rock girl. I shouldn't say I'm a rock girl.
You're not a rock girl. But, you know, the music was just, it just hit my heart. It was absolutely everything that I love. So, and if people follow my profile on Facebook, I actually, you know, when music comes up that I like, I'll share it. So.
Yeah, me too. I've broken away from music just because I don't have time for it. But I actually posted one of my songs the other day for the first time in a long time, because I was talking to a client about anti-bullying, because she wrote a book that kind of has a strong anti-bullying message, which is something that's always been very important to me. And I had written a song about it, and I dropped it the other day, but I've been so heavily involved in the writing world for so long that music is starting to take a little bit of a backseat, which is strange because I never thought that would happen.
Yeah. Yeah. As we're speaking right now, my husband's in the bedroom playing the guitar. So
nice.
It's always awesome. Nice when I'm writing and he starts, you know, picks up the guitar and starts playing, because it just, it seeps in and soothes.
No, that's amazing. Unfortunately, I've never been able to play. I've always been, you know, vocals and melodies and lyrics and having to write with somebody else. I'm pretty sure that if I could play, I would still be doing that. But having to rely on you know, especially during the last couple of years. With COVID and everything, having to meet with people and do it. Anyway, that's for another time, because I would like to actually discuss your soon to be box set release. Happening, very exciting, happening this month.
The
21st, Season of the Dragon, which is fantastic for anyone that is into strong, badass heroines and dragons. This is a fantastic trilogy.
Thank you.
So before we get into what Season of the Dragon is all about, and I get you to do the book and a pint, sell your book thing that we do every every episode. I want to start at the beginning and just find out a little bit more about when you knew you wanted to be a writer and kind of what led to your first publication, because you have so many books.
Yes. Yes.
And I don't, it blows my mind because I'm a very slow writer.
Okay.
So,
there's nothing wrong with that. I just write fast, and I've always, I guess, typed fast.
Right.
And I have to attribute that to my day job, where I'm a business analyst typing, you know, technical documents. So, you know, I wrote my first book when I was 12. And my dad actually gave it to me, a few years ago and said, "This is what you wrote." And he kept it all these years. You know, it had the little yarn things and the hole punches. But, you know, I wrote when I was 12. I wrote in an English class when I was 13 and all through high school, took creative writing classes in college. And then I got married and got into the real world and stopped. Because back then, when I wrote, it consumed me. Not saying that it doesn't now, but I had no sense of balance. I had no sense that if I was on a roll to stop and eat or stop and sleep. So it was kind of a detrimental.
I was just talking to my wife about that the other day, and sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to make sure that I got to that point.
Yes.
The life of a writer,
yep.
The life of any creative, mm-hmm. like my wife is doing her PhD right now, and she's basically, she can literally work on it all day long and not even think about eating. And when I was doing music, I was like that. And when I get into a writing zone, mm-hmm. I can be like that too. And I think creatives can do that. Just like get so heavily into a zone that they don't even realize they haven't eaten.
Right, right. Well, you know, a hurricane or a tornado could have smashed the house around me and I wouldn't know it and I'd still be writing.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's when I'm in the zone, that's what happens. And, you know, for a newlywed, that's really not cool. Put it that way. And, you know, and when you have to, you know, have a day job, it's really not cool to go there with zero sleep. So I had to put it on the back burner. And I did. You know, I worked in television at first, and then I went into insurance. You know, I was writing manuals and helping things that way. So I was getting my creative juices out in some very dry manner, but they were, you know, I was using my creative side to do things. And then, in 2007, sorry, I have to go back. I was put in a management position, so I wasn't writing and it affected me. And I couldn't really pinpoint what was wrong. And I was, you know, grouchy. And anybody who's a writer that goes through a period of time not writing will know exactly what I'm talking about. It was this lack of being able to do the creative stuff when I wanted to. And I was bitching about it in the car. And my daughter, who was 12 at the time, said, "Well, if you could do, you know, whatever you would like to do, what would you do?" And it was instantaneous. I'd write a book and get it published. And then she asked the magic question, "Well, why don't you?" And at that time she was 12, my son was 7. And, you know, I looked over at my husband and he shrugged. He said, "Well, you know, at this point, I think, you know, we're out of the honeymoon phase." He says, "Yeah, go for it." And I'm like, "Are you sure? Because you remember." I'm like, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Yeah." And so,
you know that if I write one book, I'm going to write about 600 in the next few years.
Exactly. So, you know, and honestly, he did not know what it meant. He did not know that he would have to be doing the housework and the yard work. And I would be taking the kids to all their things and writing while they did all their activities.
Right.
And writing at night, writing at on weekends. And in 15 months, I wrote 8 books.
Wow.
Yes. And then it took me 3.5 years to edit all of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's definitely, that's definitely the second, third, fourth, fifth drafts are definitely where it gets you.
Yep. And I just pounded them out and then went back and started cleaning them. So, and it took 3 years for my first publishing contract to come through. And it wasn't actually the first book I wrote. It was the fourth book that I wrote that became my first. So,
so let me ask you a question. So based on everything that you've just said, and going back to the whole, you know, being married thing with, yes. And having the husband situation, and having him be there to watch you write all these books, something I deal with, and I'm wondering if you've had to deal with the same thing, is my wife is incredibly supportive of my writing.
Yeah.
And she is my alpha. So, she doesn't read the books. I read them to her because mm-hmm. I like to hear the flow of the book and make sure that it sounds good to me, and she will listen to everything. As somebody who has written so many books and so many different series, have you ever gotten you're already on to this next series. Why don't you like work on this one? And then, or are you in that position as well where you're kind of always thinking the new thing you're doing or the thing that you want to do with these characters in the series, like way after, is way more exciting than what you're actually working on now or what you're actually putting out right now? I never had that. Well, why don't you work on one, and then why don't we see where that goes and stuff like that?
No, I mean, my husband is incredibly supportive. You know, I've asked him to read things before, but he's never suggested. Well, he's suggested some things that I've actually listened to in a couple instances, but you know, he has no idea where my. You know, my whatever comes from. And we just had a fox walk through the backyard. Sorry. Sorry. That just sort of took my attention. I'm like, oh, look at the pretty fox. But yeah, exactly. But you know, he gave me feedback in one of my early, Steve Williams series. I had him read it. And he got so mad at me because the ending was not satisfactory. And I hadn't published it yet. So that was good. He got so mad, and he explained why he was angry with me and what was wrong with it. And I was able to turn it around and fix it and write an ending that was more satisfactory than what I was. But, you know, I had to do some major revisions because of that. But that's the only time he's ever really gotten angry at a book I wrote.
Yeah. My wife was like that with the first book in the final trilogy of our series, Portrait of Dirk.
Yeah.
I had outlined, because it's kind of like that book is kind of like two separate sections. There's the personal stream of consciousness side, which I wrote, and then there's the outline that I wrote for my co-writer James, which is more of a standard epic fantasy about this character Dirk that I'm talking about in my sections.
Yes.
And when I read her the outline, she had some very strong suggestions that she thought would make Dirk's story a lot more believable and make people care about this character a lot more. And as I went through it, I was like, wow, you know, you're really right. And I used those ideas and it turned into a really good story. So it's really cool when you've got, like, you know, somebody that lives with you, that cares enough about what you're doing, that you can run those ideas off of them and they'll be brutally honest with you.
Well, my husband listened, because I used to call Katie, my co-writer for the Running from the Devil series, on our rides home from the beach, because it was about 2 hours, and it was about the time of night that, you know, Katie was available, because she's in Las Vegas, so we have, you know, time differentials. And he used to listen to us go back and forth on storylines. And then and he actually said something in one part and said, why don't you do this? You know, after, because he's read them both. And he goes, after reading that, this is probably, you know, a better direction. And both of us thought about it. Both of us talked offline. And it actually ended up being a direction we thought was viable. But and the other day I was asking him, you know, I'm like, I'm at an impasse. I could do this or this. And he just looks at me because he doesn't know the whole realm of it. I just said I might have an impasse. I could do this or this. So no frame of reference. And he just kind of looked at me blankly. He goes, I don't know. I'm like, okay, well, you're no help. so you know, he has no clue where I get my ideas, and and yeah. stuff. He is a great help when I need him to be, especially awesome. When I have, you know, architectural questions or certain engineering questions.
That's awesome. So I want to just sort of, I have a, I want to go in a couple other directions, mm-hmm. later on, but seeing as, we hope everybody will listen to all these shows all the way through, but at the very least, I would want people to listen to this. So this is the segment where I just say pitch your book or pitch your series. So, we're talking about Season of the Dragon, which is, the trilogy's out, the box set's coming out, this January 21st. Yes. So what I want you to tell our community is why they should be grabbing this box set or binging on these singles, a little bit about the series, about the characters, and why this should be their next purchase.
Well, it's a post-apocalyptic urban fantasy that takes place in New York City. And I pitch it as Independence Day meets Godzilla. So,
sold.
Yes, pretty much. You know, you have Independence Day, but without not aliens, but monsters. And we, the human race, is fighting for our survival. And at this point, when the book starts, we're not doing so well on that fight. enter our main character, Holly. She is a post-monsters military person, but she doesn't really have true military training. And she is sent to negotiate with the monsters for our freedom. and things don't go well, but one of the dragons, has seen what the monsters want and has decided that's not what he wants. So he helps her out. And that makes them both, big targets throughout the series. They're trying to defeat the monsters. The monsters are trying to destroy them. So thus, Independence Day meets Godzilla.
That sounds actually really, really awesome. And I did start reading it, and I love the prose, and I love the Holly just seems like a really, really, like, just say the word badass, but she's just, she's a little bit, she strikes me as a little bit jaded. And,
she's smart.
She just seems like the type of strong heroine that I like to read about. And this sounds like a really, really cool series. I'm running an event, this coming week. Have you ever read Steve McHugh's work?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so that's for after. I'm going to invite you to a cool little thing that, a cool little online event, but that's not really for the podcast, but this, it sounds like it would be a perfect match for an event that, is geared towards urban fantasy. So that sounds really awesome. Obviously, community, that listens to the podcast on a regular basis, January 21st, the box set comes out. Digital box sets are always a really great deal. We're going to be doing a celebration event in Fantasy Sci-Fi Focus, with Jane, geared towards this series. So be there, check it out, pick it up, because it's awesome. Now I would like to, move into the direction of your publishing, because I know that you self-publish now. Yeah. Have you always self-published? Because you had mentioned at one point having a publishing contract, and I wasn't aware of that. So.
Yeah, I my first series, the game series, was picked up by Accessica Publishing when they were a true publisher before they became a partnership with authors instead of publisher. And they had a spinoff that did Dark Reckoning and Vengeance, which was, one was the erotic side. Accessica was erotic, which survival games is an erotic thriller. And then Dark Reckoning was their, I guess, straight brand, which is thrillers and horror and things like that. So I had that, and then they dissolved. And at that point in time, one of the people that I had edited for under those, titles or those publishers, I became an editor and a formatter for them. So I learned all the back stuff to be able to pick it up myself. But one of the people that I edited for, he writes science fiction too. And he approached me and said, do you want to start our own publishing house? And I'm like, sure. So we did Novel Concept Publishing, which is still out there today, but we're really quite picky on our books that we sign on.
Right.
At this point, because it's like, do I want to edit or and publish, or do I want to write? The answer obviously is write.
Yeah.
So it has to be really, really good before I step back from writing to take on a new author. And we have 6 or 7 authors under us. Unfortunately, 2 of them passed away.
Oh my God, I'm sorry.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was hard. One of them, I was editing his books while he was going through, stage 4, colon cancer.
Wow.
And he and his wife thanked me afterwards. He said, you didn't let up on him because of his disease. I said, no, I wanted him to write the good book. So yes, my nickname from my publishing partner, the bitch with the red pen, is really accurate.
I totally I get what you're saying, though, about that kind of dichotomy between, you know, obviously I have a large publicity company. That's what I have not gotten to the point where writing has in any way been more than kind of just a very small residual. And I haven't even released most of my books yet. That's all happening this year.
Okay.
But I do run a publishing, a small press, Fallbrandt Press as well. And we also have about 7 authors that we've signed to us. And we're very picky about who we put out because we want to make sure that we can actually devote enough attention to the people that we have on deadlines and stuff like that. So, and we're very meticulous about how we do it and what we spend, and that we put money into our authors' advertising and make sure that we get if their covers are below par, we'll invest in covers from, you know, pro designers to make sure that things are making the grade.
Yes.
So to do that right, you know, you can't sign 200 people because then you're going to be 2 years behind on your live deadlines and stuff like that.
Exactly.
And I've seen that happen way too many times.
Yep.
So how many books have you actually self-published?
I have 61 books out.
Wow. Okay. 60, so
counting the most recent, which was Silent Night, it was a short story I threw together in a month.
Right. So let me ask you this, because you're definitely a pro when it comes to this process. What have you loved about the whole process of self-publishing? Like, what have you found to be the biggest joys in the entire experience? And also, what have you found, I guess, to be the biggest stumbling blocks and obstacles? Because I'm sure with 61 books published during, you know, a relatively short period of time, you will have experienced both joys and setbacks.
Right. I mean, I like the fact that I can control every facet of the publishing from, you know, when I release. And if I have something set and I'm done early, I can actually move it up. I have that control, you know, to a point, because there is, you know, when you do a pre-order, there is an early date that, you know, if you're saying, oh, I can go live today, but you really can't because you've got a pre-order. So you have to go in, I think it's 7 days from the day or 4 days or, you know, depending upon the platform. But that ability to pivot and also the ability to say, I'm not going to meet a deadline, which I've only done once, and push the date out.
Right.
You know, that the timing of it is important. I mean, I schedule my editor in advance. So I put the pressure on me to get the book to the editor because they're relying on the income, you know, and that's how I do what I do and put out what I put out, because I have editing things. And as I said, I've only moved one of those once, and that was because of a death in my co-writer's family. When I told her I'm moving this, and she's like, no, you don't. You don't have to. I'm like, yes, I do. I need to give you the time. So, you know, having that control and ability to move back and forth is good. The ability to choose my covers and get the, you know, cover artists I want. And I do a lot of that in advance now. So I have a backlog of covers that I need to write to that I know what I'm going to be writing for the next couple of years. So that's the facet I like. The right. facet that I am challenged with is the marketing and publicity end, because right. I am not a big, hey, look at me, look at my book person. You know, I'm more willing to do that for all my friends' books and everything like that than stand up on the mountain and say, look at what I've done.
Right.
So
oh, yeah.
That is the biggest challenge for me. And, you know, and hopefully doing this more and more. I mean, I do Spilling Ink Saturday nights with Katie, but, that's more about everybody else. So stepping into the other side on podcasts and webcasts has been interesting and fun.
My kids are fighting upstairs. Sorry,
okay.
I hope it doesn't come through. Things like that this what I just said can be edited out, by the way.
That's okay. You can even keep it in. I'm all for
it. It's all about the fun.
It's all about real life too.
It is,
you know.
What you said about that, first of all, it's funny because I remember I think I contacted you years ago about Spilling Ink.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to
you probably contacted Katie, yeah.
It could have been Katie. Yeah. I don't remember. Yeah. It was a long time ago, but I'd love to hear more about that, what you guys do as well. But based on what you just said, I think 99% of the people I ask that question to, because I ask it every single interview, because I'm obviously, as a publisher and a publicist and a self-publisher, it's always something that interests me, and I like to hear different perspectives. Marketing usually is the number one. One of the things about the self-publishing model, though, that works, especially for prolific authors and authors that always have that creative buzz and a new idea in their head and a new book they want to get out, is that for me, why I love it so much is that I can do that.
Yes.
Because if I even attempted to go a traditional route, first of all, there's the waiting and the way you wait to query, you wait to get the agent, then you've got to wait sometimes years to pitch the book, and then you get your advance, and then the book comes out. And if you're lucky, you can put out a book every year and a half, according to these publisher schedules, but usually it's like every 2 years.
That's true in most cases, but then I look at like John Mayberry. He puts out a lot of books in short periods of time. Well, actually, he finishes it and goes through the editing process. It does take some time, but he's got at least 4 to 6 books a year.
Yeah, I mean,
it also
depends on where you're at when it comes to priority to the publisher.
Right,
and
he's pretty big. Like, he's got the Marvel side.
If you look at a company like Tor Books or Orbit, when we're talking about fantasy, they're working on, like, and I have a lot of friends that are signed to both of those companies. And if you look at their release schedules, it's like, you know, maybe once a year. Every once in a while, Orbit will do like a 2 in 1 year.
Yes.
But there's still a lot of waiting, and there's, you know, a lot of these authors are working on their, on trilogies of series that are going to be sitting there that nobody's allowed to see for 2 years. And I don't think I'd be able to handle that.
Yeah. I just like to, turn and burn.
Exactly. And that's why. Another thing is, you know, there is a stigma, when it comes to self-publishing, which I find, I've spoken to a lot of authors about this, and really, it's like there's a movement of authors that are doing exceptional work, that are putting out exceptionally edited product with beautiful covers, that are kind of breaking the stigma about self-publishing, which is that anyone can put out a book.
Right.
Unfortunately, there are also examples, you know, of covers that look like they were designed on a Commodore 64 from 1982.
Right.
That are kind of, putting some of those roadblocks in the way of people that are really treating it like, that have their ear to the street and are really treating this like a business.
Right. Right. Yeah. In 2010, I didn't know anything about cover art either. So.
Yeah. No, I think it's a learning process. It's indie authors are multiplying, like gremlins that are fed after midnight.
Every
time you look on Amazon, you're shown another beautiful cover, or three by an author you've never heard of before.
Getting visibility is tough, which, you know, that's the name of the game is visibility too.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are definitely ways to do it. And there are ways to, there are sciences and mathematics to the process. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that everybody's kind of vying for is to get that visibility.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's shift gears a little bit, back to, the actual books, back to your actual books, and your writing in general. I'm always interested in this because a tactic that I employ always in my writing, probably a little bit too much, is a little bit of an egocentric use of myself and people in my own life to kind of create my characters. So in my case, I'll either have avatars of me or examples of me that I kind of would like to be more like, or I'll actually include myself as a character in my books. And the women, my female MCs are almost always versions of my wife. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they even have almost the same name as my wife. So, and I do that a lot. I really look into my personal life and I bring a lot of that into my writing. Is this something that you do as well when you're writing and are there specific examples where you've really, really done this?
No, I do not put real people into my books. Maybe characteristics of multiple peoples, yes. But I have strayed way far away from putting real people in. There's a reason for that. it's kind of, you know, morbid and maybe a little supernatural. But when I was in high school writing a short story, I wrote about somebody, and in the story, he died. And a couple of years later in real life, he died in the same scenario.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, nope, never again. So, you know, but my husband does tell me there's a little bit of me in all of my characters. He can see, you know, a little bit of me in it, whether I'm, you know, doing it on purpose or not, I don't know. But I did write about, it's sort of a memoir that I made into fiction about my high school years. And I was the subject of a bully, and it's called Silence. But that is the one book before Silent Night that my daughter did read because she begged me to write it. So, you know, that's out there.
Well, that makes sense. Well,
but, you know, yeah, and my villains do take on a real person, but it's all because I was in a newsroom when I was an intern in college, and I used to have to sit in the courtroom waiting for verdicts. And there was one particular murder case that the guy was in there, and I swear he had no soul. And that's the person that I, you know, draw on for my really bad villains, because it's just, he just was eerie.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. And he did get the death penalty. So
it's always villains are tough. I find I draw a lot from movies, especially mob movies.
Yeah.
You know, like my first villain in the first couple books was like a complete rip off on, I write satirical stuff, so it's kind of meant to do this way, but pretty much Michael Corleone's character in The Godfather.
Okay, yeah.
was pretty much the bad guy, and with a little bit of Joe Pesci thrown in.
Yep.
But anyway, it's very interesting, and thank you for sharing that story about the reason you don't do that. If you do ever want to break the trend, you can fully put me into a story where it's warm out all the time and where I win the lottery.
Okay. And yes. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
You never know. That would be awesome. I've actually been, I've made it into one book that wasn't mine.
Yeah.
Which was kind of cool. I think I may have been killed off, but then he told me that he felt bad about that. And he thinks that I'm actually not going to be dead, just badly injured.
Okay.
So, but I'm always for being put in people's books. I think that's really cool. So, yeah. But yeah, thank you. Like I said, in all seriousness, that's a good reason for not doing that. And I appreciate you sharing that with me.
Right. You know it.
Sticking on the topic of influences, so what are some of your biggest, I know you mentioned Stephen King at the beginning, but mm-hmm. Other influences when it comes to writers and authors, maybe movies or TV that have shaped your writing?
I read a lot of, as I said, Stephen King as a kid and a teenager and in college. I read Dean Koontz because I like his dark stuff. I read Sidney Sheldon, Lawrence Sanders. I mean, I still remember the first Deadly Sin and the third Deadly Sin. Those three books I think I read when I was, you know, like 30 plus years ago, and I can still remember the story arcs. Of course, those are serial killer stuff.
Right.
And then, you know, from my youth, when I was really young, going to New Hampshire, my grandfather had the entire Edgar Rice Burroughs Tarzan series that I used to read during the week.
Right. I was looking at those the other day.
Yep. The adventure of those. And, you know, and I still have some here because I think I got the set when he passed. In middle school, I liked all the wolf stories and the horse stories, you know, all horses go to heaven and all dogs go to heaven and, you know, things like Silverteeth and White Fang. Those were things that I read in middle school. So I've got a lot of different genres and it wasn't until I started being a writer that I started discovering urban fantasy.
Right.
More than the horror and the thrillers and stuff, you know. So, being an indie writer, I don't think I would have found some of the incredible writers that I've read recently if I was not in this business, which is kind of sad, but it's true.
I totally agree with you. I was never really, people will find this surprising, but for the majority of my life, I read literary fiction for the most part, mm-hmm. classics and then, you know, kind of more modernist stuff like Kurt Vonnegut and mm-hmm. Salman Rushdie and David Foster Wallace and Chuck Palahniuk and, you know, authors like that kind of had the James Joyce influence. I love really, can't get too abstract for me.
Yeah.
That's my favorite thing.
English minor, actually English major and communications major, I had a lot of literature that I had to read through college and, you know, those were my favorite courses.
Yeah, I was an English major as well, English and psychology major.
Yes, yes.
I definitely, and I totally agree. Discovering, you know, indie fantasy, which opened my eyes up to the subgenres like urban fantasy and satirical fantasy and steampunk. My first exposure to satirical fantasy was an author who at the time was indie, and it was not Terry Pratchett, but it mm-hmm. opened my eyes up to the Discworld series, which really sparked my interest in fantasy in general. As opposed to Lord of the Rings, which I read afterwards, mm-hmm. Which is usually people's gateway. I still haven't made it through Wheel of Time. You know what I mean? And I feel a little bit, sometimes I feel a bit sacrilege saying that, but it's just what's happened. That's really cool. Let me ask you, this will probably be a loaded question because of how quickly you write. But what's coming next for you? After Season of the Dragon comes out and the trilogy is complete with the box set, what can your fans and readers expect in the next year or so?
Well, in the next year, I've got two Fractured Fairy Tales coming out in two different box sets. So Rituals and Runes has Jasmine, which is a fairy tale rewrite of Aladdin.
I saw that. I don't pay attention to the order that things are coming out, but I saw the cover and it looks absolutely stunning.
Yeah. And then I have Belle coming out in Shifters Ever After. which is a Beauty and the Beast rewriting, where she's right. She's the beast in this case. So, you know, I flipped the fairy tales, in that series. So I have those two coming out, one in June and one in October. And then in March, June and September, the Shades of Night, trilogy will be out. So I'm starting that. That's a vampire hunter or huntress. I'll put it that way. Urban fantasy. So, you know, she's hunting vampires and things don't go as planned. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think I saw you drop the cover for that one recently too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Your cover is like, honestly, like, especially on some of the more recent books, like could literally like be in a museum that people could just stare at. They're absolutely stunning.
Yeah. I have a cover fetish.
Yeah. Well, that's really important. Honestly, like, I'm somewhat ashamed to say this, but I really am a judge a book by its cover person at first, especially in indie, because there's just so much out there.
Right.
That a lot of times that will be the thing. Just, I know that I won't necessarily get to reading it right away, but I want to have my Kindle or I want to have it on my bookshelf.
Yeah.
Because eventually I'll get to it. And it's those beautiful covers that are the things that make you want to find out a little bit more and then read the blurb and then read the first few chapters and decide whether you want to keep going.
Absolutely. I mean, the hardcover Season of the Dragon is absolutely beautiful. I did do that one early. So the hardcover is out now, but the ebook trilogy is coming out on the 21st. But I did that for if anybody wanted to do Christmas gifts. So I did that in the beginning of December. At the time.
Is that an omnibus? Is that like a complete series hardcover?
Yes. Yes. It's an omnibus, Season of the Dragon, all three books.
Wow. And that's awesome. That's amazing.
Yes. Yes. And I was able to do it and it's pretty. It's really pretty.
Sounds amazing.
And my cover artist or one half of my cover artist duo agreed to do the hardcover and he did a fantastic job. So.
is this something you're going to do for the next urban fantasy series as well?
Possibly if it can fit. That's the challenge of the hardcovers. These, you know, with Amazon, there is a page limit.
Yeah.
You know, I have seven of my Fractured Fairy Tales in a hardcover, all the seven that are out right now. And I was like, ooh, can I do 10? And I can't, not unless I make the print 8. And 8 point is not easy to read. So you have to be mindful of, you know, the typeset and all of that. And I don't want the hardcovers to be, that much bigger. The ones I have are 7x10 instead of my, you know, paperbacks, which are 6x9. Right. So, you know, since Amazon, went to hardcovers, I'm like, ooh, let's try this a couple times. So.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a nice effect and very enticing for people to want to check something out, especially when you're putting them out in a complete series like that.
Yeah. I have the Nighthawk series in hardcover too. And that has, you know, the prequel, and then a short story and then the three, books, and that's a vampire romance.
Amazing. So, it sounds like you got a really, really big year ahead of you. That's super exciting for your readers and probably for yourself as well. So that's super awesome.
Yes.
So I like to, when we get to the end of this, I'm going to ask you to let everybody know where they can find you online if they want to find out more. But I like to end, and again, you seem like you would probably really have a relatively profound answer to this one, and it's an important question, so I like to end my interviews with this question. If you could offer one piece of advice to new and aspiring writers, what would it be?
Finish the story. That's easy. So I mean, having an idea for a book is wonderful, but get it all out before you edit it. If you're searching for the perfection on the page before you move on, you'll never get that book done.
Right.
It will always haunt you. So finish the story, even if it's like a straw man, you know, conversation between the characters and you've got to fill in the detail between. As long as you finish it, get to the end of the story and then go back and edit. It's really important. Because there's so many people who start and just get stuck in that editing, you know, to make things perfect, before moving on. And it just, and they lose steam when they do that.
I actually waited 2 years almost between getting to a certain point with my first book, Alehouse Wars, and actually putting it out. And because I guess I kind of cheated. My original, I'm giving my secrets away here. my original plan was I'm good at writing characters and I'm good at writing funny stuff. But I, when it comes to magic and choreographed battles and stuff like that, forget about it. Just, it's not something I enjoy writing, but I did want to have that in my book. And I was stumped and I didn't know what to do. I knew how I wanted it to end and I knew what, but I was stuck at this point. So, I had read, J.M.D. Reed's Storm Below, which is one of my favorite epic fantasies of all time. And he's brilliant with choreographed battles. He had airships and he had crazy battles on creatures. And it was just tons of magic and all kinds of crazy stuff happening that seemed just like a choreographed film. And I just said, you know, James, do you think you can, cause I know, cause he works as a ghostwriter.
Yeah.
So I said, do you think you can just sort of ghostwrite me through this scene where there's going to be a big battle? And he said, sure. So that's what we had coordinated.
Okay.
And he did it, and he did it off my outline, and it was better than I ever could have imagined. And then he ended up having a lot of fun doing it. And then I said, well, why don't I just put your name on the cover instead, and we can just have this thing as a co-write. And one thing led to another, and now we have like 12 books written and a 13th on the way.
Yeah, the battle scenes are always fun. My co-writer Katie, she actually has swords and she blocks them out in her house. So with wooden swords, not real swords. And then, you know, I have my son who's a black belt in Jiu-Jitsu. And I ask him, well, you know, and in the past, I've asked his instructor, well, if I want to do this, what would I have the character do? And they've actually shown it to me. So seeing it, you know, and having it explained was really helpful. I kind of miss the days being in the dojo. But it's really tough to write a good fight scene.
Definitely. And I basically resigned to the fact that that wasn't my strength, and I don't really have that much of an interest in doing it, but I still want those elements to be there. So that's kind of where the collaboration took place.
Absolutely.
So I totally agree with you. You know, find a way to get to the end, and then you can always go back and write things in afterwards, little specifics and things.
Layer the writing. I call it the layer of the writing, the descriptions, the senses, everything.
So that's excellent advice. Because you are one of those authors that many new writers would probably be intimidated by, specifically regarding the degree of output that you have. Whenever I'm talking to prolific writers, I'm sure you've experienced, you know, in the past, people that you've spoken to that are struggling to get one book done or have gotten one book done and have not been able to even get a proper outline for a second, that would say, like, how do you have like 61 books written? What's your secret? What do you do? I wish I could write more like that. I know other authors that are in also similar situations. So one of the things that I would add in a situation like that is, you know, you do you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You can't hold yourself to impossible standards, because not everybody can write 7 to 10 books a year. And that's okay.
Right. Exactly.
You know, I feel like I'm writing torrents and torrents and torrents of words. And I feel really good when I'm doing it. And I'm buzzing while I'm writing them. And then I'll always go into a word counter because I'll want to know how many words I wrote for each given, you know, sitting. Yeah. And I'll think I've written like 55,000 words, and it'll be like 8,500 to 10,000 words. And I'll be like looking at it going, what? How is that even possible?
Right.
And I'm not a fast writer. And that's just the way it is. But to hold to hold myself to the standard of somebody that can write, 20,000 words a day.
I don't write 20,000 words a day. I just sit down and write.
Well, I'm not insinuating that you do, but
yeah, I know, but some people do. So, you know, absolutely. I don't know if this was my full time gig, if it would be different. My output might be even, greater, but it's not my full time endeavor.
Right. So, to go with that, yeah, basically you do you. Everybody's got their own pace.
Yep.
Everybody's got their own. It's more important to actually write it.
Right. To get it done.
To realize that writing a novel, even one novel, is like a major bucket list thing. Like
it is.
About people's bucket lists of things that they want to do with themselves and with their lives. Writing a book is on a lot of people's, and a lot of people never get that done never do it. So just to get that novel written is huge.
Yes, absolutely. It is. It is. And, however you do it, whether you're a pantser or a plotter or, just as you say, you do you, and don't hold yourself next to somebody and feel bad or feel that you're not doing enough, because that's not okay either. That's right. Self-defeating.
Yeah. And all creatives know that they've got that kind of inner saboteur that's always in there kind of saying, is this good enough? Is this good enough? So
right.
Really important to try to ignore that voice and just do what you do. Jane, where can people find more about you online if they want to check out your library of books and find out more about what you've got going on?
Okay, I have a website, and it's www.jetaylor75.com. That also has links to my Facebook page, my Instagram, my LinkedIn, my Twitter. I know I'm forgetting something, but it's there. And my blog is also embedded into the first page of my website. So you can see, my recent blogs, which, I'm fairly inconsistent on blogging because I'm writing.
Aren't we all?
Yes. So, you can see that, and all my books are out there. There's a series page, and there's a book page. There's a coming up page. There's an about me page, and then there's a Ryan series, chronological events of the Ryan family. If you've read anything of mine with the Ryan family in it, that shows you all the books that they're in. Because I've crossed series a lot.
Nice. Excellent. Well, Jane, it's been an absolute pleasure, and obviously very interested in the next year and all the awesome stuff you have coming out. Wishing you the best of luck with your launch on the 21st for Season of the Dragon and everything else you have coming in the future.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being here.
Thank you for being here. Take care.
All right. Bye.
This has been Authors in Focus. You can find my satirical fantasy novels on Amazon. Need help finding readers? Connect with me on Facebook in the Fantasy Sci-Fi Focus group or at authorsinfocus@gmail.com. You can find more episodes of this podcast at fantasy-focus.com and where your favorite podcasts are hosted.